Good morning. My name is Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic, and so grateful to be here. Boy, if we had a time this weekend, I promise you, I am honored, truly honored to have been here. It's always exciting for me when my wife and I are both asked to speak. And for those of you who missed the Al-Anon talk, do yourself a big favor and see Lee and get a copy of that. Miss Linda knocked it out here. She always does. And Tammy, who's here in the front row, is one of my favorites. Boy, I just bawled. I needed a salt tablet when your talk was over. I'm telling you, I just absolutely bawled. I want to thank Janine and everyone who worked so hard to put this on. These things don't just happen. And some people spent a lot of time and a lot of heart, and I'm grateful for it. And I want to thank George for safe travel from the airport. We had an uneventful drive. It's my favorite kind. And it was just great. And I am a member of the backroom group in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm very proud of my home group. I'm probably going to brag on them a little bit while I'm up here. I want to, just for fun, just to get a feel for who's in here, see the hands of the folks sober 6 months or less. I'm not even going to call on you. Wonderful. Boy, is that great, huh? All right. Congratulations to whoever's doing the great work to get these new folks here. And welcome. I'm glad you're here. You are the ones I came to talk to. You own a very special piece of my heart because I know how you feel, because I once had less than 6 months too. Everybody in this room knows how you feel. It may be the first time you've ever been in a room where everyone knew how you felt. Powerful for me. I'd also like to see the hands of the Al-Anons, please. Thank you for your support. I appreciate you being here. I am much honored by your presence. My wife's an active member of your fellowship, and I'm going to tell you, her Al-Anon program is so good, I have a sign on my desk that says, Ask Linda. Because if I want to know what she thinks about something I'm fixing to say or do, I have to ask her, because she ain't working my case. To tell you this, she doesn't even help me look for a parking place if I don't ask her to. Wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, so as a matter of fact, over my way, they say Al-Anon's a pretty great thing because there's some alcoholics that originally got sober because Al-Anon helped one of you get too healthy to continue to help one of us stay sick. So I'd like to salute you because I really mean that. And I like to open my talks with a quote. Oh, and I want to thank the committee, too, for allowing me to do the STEP workshop on Friday. Nobody had more fun than I did, and nobody learned more than I did. There were new things for me, and I am so grateful to have had that chance. And for those of you who are here, some of this will be redundant, okay, because I only got one story, and I don't want it to be interesting enough, bad enough, to go get another one. So we're just going to have to stick with what we got here, okay? So I apologize for that. But I'd like to quote Lois Wilson, co-founder of Al-Anon, who was asked what she did in the moment of silence before the Serenity Prayer. She said, I invite God to the meeting. And it isn't that I don't believe God's here. I do believe that. But I get a special gift when I stop and acknowledge that presence. And what I'd like to suggest is with this many new folks in the room, there well may be someone who doesn't have a God, or you got one you're afraid of, or something's not working for you. And if you are that person, I want to invite you to borrow my God for this time we're together. This morning, I'm quite serious. You can address him as the God of Scott's limited understanding. Just get off on the right foot, because that's the truth. And I like to say I recommend him highly. He's been keeping me sober for a very long time, in my opinion. And he also has a great sense of humor. And if you don't think so, look around the room. I think we're pretty funny. So anyway, what I'd like to do is to ask you, if you would, please, to let's have a moment of silence and each in our own way acknowledge the presence of the Great Spirit and ask for open hearts. And I'll meet you back here. Amen. Thank you. And that takes all the heat off of me, doesn't it? I feel much better. I was asked to tell my story this morning, and I found the directions on how to do that here in the big book. I know some of you are familiar with this book because I've been hearing you laugh all weekend. It's been my experience that people who get into this book and do what it says laugh a lot. I think laughter is a sound effect of recovery. The directions I found here on page 29. It says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. So that must be my subject. I did not begin my life searching for a relationship with God. I began my life a victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I managed well. Recognize that? It's on page 61. I'm so insane that I thought if I could get what I wanted, it would make me happy. Boy, am I a poor observer. I mean, I got what I wanted lots of times. Didn't you? Didn't you? Are you happy? I mean, did it work? It just kept not working, and I kept not noticing. I'm a poor observer. I don't want to tamper with our customs, but I swear I want to say my name is Scott, and I have a learning disability known as alcoholism. I mean, it is at least in some ways that, isn't it? How could I have gone on that long and not seen the truth about what was happening in my life? But anyway, I didn't begin drinking until I was 18 years old. I'm sponsoring a guy that's sober a year and a half that just turned 18. If I can think of it later, I'm going to quote. Well, I'll quote him now. James said something powerful in my home group. He said, AA gave me my future back. Wow. You think the room doesn't freeze when James talks? Listen, let me tell you, this boy's something. We are blessed with variety in our lives, astounding variety. The reason I didn't drink until I was 18 is because I didn't know what it would do. I needed to drink the day before I went to kindergarten. Didn't you? Didn't you? I certainly did. I have a good friend from Australia, and I have his permission to use his line. He says he was born two beers short of normal. I got that. That's exactly what happened to me. Anyway, I went away to college. I got out with the boys. They started drinking beer, so I started drinking beer because I wanted to be one of the boys, something terrible. Somewhere between the first sip of that first one and the bottom of the second one, the magic happened for me. Now, if you're an alcoholic, you know what I'm talking about. Magic. I was suddenly taller. Now, let me tell you something. I didn't come this far to talk to you. I come to talk with you. We're doing this together this morning. Who got taller when they drank? Come on. Let's see. Come on, Suzette. I know you did. Put your hand up. All right. And better looking? Okay. You get better looking? My pimples fell right off. I was surprised at the Super Bowl this year that they hadn't figured that out, one of the ad agencies, because I can just see the ad on the Super Bowl, you know, Budweiser cures acne. Cured mine. Of course, it relapsed the next morning, but I was a handsome devil that night. Oh, you should have seen me that night. I was something to look at. Mm-hmm. And fantastic dancer. Any dancers? Any doubles on the dancer? Did I get two from anybody? Holy mackerel, I could shake it. Yes, sirree. Yeah, baby. Expert on many subjects. Did you get smart? Come on, did you get smart? Oh, man, I'm going to tell you later how smart I got. Oh, boy, did I ever get smart. Yeah. I'll tell you the biggest one it did for me, though, is it made me feel like I was as good as everybody else. I never had that feeling before in my whole life. I do not know how this happened, but sometime at a time that predates my memory when I was a little fellow, I became convinced somehow that I was not as good as everyone else. I was somehow defective and unworthy, and that could not be changed. It could not be repaired. And I became an actor as a very small boy. And my act was I pretended to be whoever I thought the people immediately in front of me wanted me to be. At the end of my drinking, I had a customer in Morristown, Tennessee. He's a very serious Baptist, and he knew a religious me. Had a customer in Knoxville, had a pretty good time on Friday night, and he knew Friday night me. Had the boys in the pool room where I drank and bought my dope, and they knew that me. I had neighbors, and they knew neighbor me, and I had family, and they knew family me, and I had business partners, and they knew business partner me. I'm a different guy to everybody. What's my greatest fear? Is that people from different parts of my life be together in the same place at the same time, right? Because how am I going to act? Because I've been an actor all my life. And I've been acting so long, I don't have the faintest notion who stands behind the last mask. I do not know anything about who I actually am. That's how I got to you. But anyway, back to being 18 years old and out with the college boys and drinking Sterling beer. Anybody drink any Sterling beer? Yeah, they don't make that anymore, which I think is good. One of my definitions of willpower is ordering the second Sterling beer. Right, Tammy? Oh, that stuff was, that horse had diabetes. The stuff was $1 a gallon, all right? It really was. I'm going to tell you when that was. With Tennessee state sales tax, it was $1.02. All right? So now we've established the time frame. I'm telling you, it was the greatest feeling I'd ever had. And we went from, I'm afraid you're going to find out who I really am and run me off, to, y'all's pretty lucky I'm here. And I'm all of a sudden as good as everybody and quite honestly better than most. Huh? Know what I mean? Sure. That's what it did for me. Because if alcohol hadn't done so much for me, it could have never done anything to me. Couldn't have. Because it doesn't do to people who don't have that sort of effect from it. The earth people that this doesn't work for, they don't have to come to this thing. Because it didn't work for them. Therefore, it wasn't able to beat them to death. Anyway, I try to fast forward because we do have a midnight flight tonight and I need to get to it. I zipped through a 4-year college and 5 years and 2 summer schools. Amen? Yeah, okay. And a few events, I suspected. And I actually graduated, Vince. Did you? All right. Okay, yeah. And I graduated probably for the same reason you do. The staff at that college finally figured out that I was going to keep coming back. They let me out. And the United States Air Force gave me a commission as a second lieutenant. I went to Air Force pilot training in Valdosta, Georgia, not too far from here. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what that was like. We flew the little Cessna 172 for the first 6 weeks, and then we moved up to the T-37, which is a twin-engine jet, fully acrobatic. It'll do a loop in 2,000 feet. It only goes about 400 miles an hour. And we flew that for the next 4.5 months, and then we moved to the T-38, which is a real airplane. Now, you guys are all familiar with the plane. You just don't know it because you saw the movie Top Gun, didn't you? And the beginning and the end of the movie, they're doing the dogfight with the MiGs. Well, the Russians didn't loan Hollywood any MiGs so they could make a movie, okay? You probably had figured that out. And this is the airplane I'm talking about. They call it a MiG. We call it the T-38. We call it the Rocket. It's a high-performance aircraft. That means it has afterburning jet engines. It will fly faster than the speed of sound. I've been through the Mach several times in this plane. It will go from brake release to 40,000 feet in 3.5 minutes. It has when this airplane first came out, they do all the test things, and it took the brake release to 40,000 foot climb record away from the F-104. It was the hottest plane in the inventory that day. It has a roll rate. If you're in level flight at cruise speed, if you just lay the stick completely against your leg in what they call a maximum deflection roll, in other words, you move the flight controls as far as they'll go, she will roll in excess of 420 degrees a second. And before you get a brain hernia doing the math, it is more than once around every second, okay? And I'll tell you what else about that. Your eyeballs won't track that if you're sober. I mean, that's... Can't watch it. It's just a blur. A loop in this aircraft, a loop is defined, I'm going to impress you now, as a 360-degree turn through the vertical plane pulling positive Gs. It's one of these guys, okay? At 10,000 feet, you enter at 500 knots. It's about 550 miles an hour. And you pull up at 5 Gs. Now, you're pulling 1 G right now. It's the force of gravity. At 1 G, a 200-pound man weighs 200 pounds. At 5 Gs, a 200-pound man weighs 1,000 pounds. That is precisely what that means. That's exactly what that means. That includes, by the way, your upper eyelids. And you've got to work to keep them from slamming shut at 5 Gs. Trust me, you will work the eyebrows to keep the eyelids from slamming shut at 5 or above. 10,000 feet, 500 knots, 5 Gs. Wings level inverted at 20,000 feet takes 10,000 feet to pull this bird over on her back. And you lose 8,000 feet coming down the backside. Total elapsed time on the maneuver is under 25 seconds. Okay? I tell you all of that about the airplane for two reasons. The first one, of course, is to impress you. Anybody? Okay. A few. Yeah. And the other one is because I think it tells the story of my alcoholism so well. Because I come down from a day of flying that airplane, and I'm going to, about 5:30, I'm going to head over to the officers' club to socialize with some of the other pilots in my squadron. Now, it is not my intent to get drunk this evening. If you ask me on the way into the club and put me on a lie detector and say, are you going to get drunk this evening? I will tell you no. And I will pass the lie detector because I know for sure I'm not going to. But I used to get drunk by mistake. Did you ever get drunk by mistake? Yeah, yeah. Just kind of take drunk. I don't know how. Maybe caught it from a doorknob or something. I just kind of, boom, and there it was. You know, maybe the guy in the next bar stool was contagious. I don't know how. You know what I mean? And I didn't think that should count. But anyway, the one thing I know for sure is that I'm not going to get drunk tonight. What? I'll tell you what. Would y'all be willing to do audience participation with me? Let's try that again. Would you be willing to do audience participation? Yeah. Yeah. Great. Wonderful. When I point at you, fill in the blanks and trust yourself. You know these answers, okay? You know the answers. Not going to get drunk tonight. Going to stop by the club and have one beer, no more than two. I noticed some of you Al-Anons didn't play. Okay, now I'm not offended by that, but I'm going to expect you to participate. You know the answers. This is what you heard on the phone. Okay? And you believed it again. That's why you're here. The ones that stopped believing it and ran screaming, they don't have to come to your thing, okay? All right. Going to have one beer, no more than... I should be home by 6:30, no later than... But what happens is that somewhere between the first sip of the first beer and the bottom of that second one, this phenomenon of craving that Dr. Silkworth talks about in the doctor's opinion happens to me. And I don't get home at 7. As a matter of fact, I leave the officers' club at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning because they...
Close.
George, I believe it's the biggest group of pilots I've ever spoken to. Golly.
I'm ready.
Yeah, man. I drive home drunk. My first wife tears into me. A lot of information in that sentence. And I go into the bathroom. I am not your Sunday morning spiritual speaker. I'm about to demonstrate that for you. I go into the bathroom for what a friend of mine refers to as his after drinking chores. Okay? I thought the most important and creative inventions of the 20th century were that, you remember that little half moon shape of carpet they put around the commode for you to kneel on? That was invented by one of our boys, you know. His knees were all torn up from that tile floor. So we ought to put a carpet around that thing. And that soft commode seat you could rest your head on, kind of in between heaves, you know. I see the hands of the pukers. Come on, where are you? These are my people, yes. Okay, who quit forever when they puked? Come on, where are you? You quit forever. You betcha. Okay, this is a harder one. Who quit forever solemn oath on the Bible in front of witnesses more than once? Where are you? Okay. All right, who peed in the closet? Come on. I never did it. I can't believe you'd admit that in public. All right. I don't believe I'd have told that, folks. No, I wouldn't have told that. I didn't do that. I did this in a jail a week ago Tuesday night. Same thing. Like 20 guys in a room, 5 hands go up on the who peed in the closet thing, and I said the same thing. I never did. I can't believe you did that. And this guy says, it wasn't no big deal. It wasn't my closet. I never did pee in the closet. My first wife is still pretty angry about that coffee table, though. It had a lip around it, you know, and so you just wouldn't lose anything. Anyway, I'm in this bathroom, and I am bringing up my toenails. And I quit forever. For those of you who are new, they're going to tell you you can't quit forever. I've quit forever over 2,000 times. And then I would pray. I call it the pre-AA prayer, okay? This is just me. It's not in the literature as such. I call it the pre-AA prayer. We're going to do it together, okay? I'm going to do the first line. You do the second line. God, get me out of this.
I'll never do it again.
You left that out. That's alcoholic for amen. I brush my teeth and go to bed, and it's now got to be 2 in the morning, 2:30, somewhere in there, right? I get up at 6. Yeah, and that wonder, Alice thought she was in Wonderland when she went through the looking glass. I wonder if when he wrote that, he was between drunk and hungover, because that's where Wonderland really is. Boy, I miss that a lot, don't you? Oh, boy, that was a great way to live. Man, that felt so good. And get up at 6, I shower and shave. You know, if Mr. Gillette had not invented the safety razor, probably you'd have a different speaker this morning. I think I would have died trying to do that. And I get cleaned up, flight suit and boots, sunglasses and hat, hop in the car, drive out to the airbase. About 7:30 in the morning, I'm in that aircraft I was telling you about. Today we're in a two-ship formation. Been to the air show? Seen what they did? The Thunderbirds flew this plane for 7 years. Okay? And just after liftoff, I've tucked under the leader's tail. And if I could stand up in my cockpit, I can almost touch his afterburners. When we land, the top half of the tail of my aircraft is going to be black from the soot from his engines. All right? I'm snug up under the leader's tail. And we're going to do 500 knots and pull 5 G's going over the top. And I'm going to be there. And I'm going to hang in. And I am dying in this plane. I have a 4-7 hangover. You remember the 4-7 has the butcher, where the butcher knife goes in here, sticks out the back? You remember that one, don't you? I was surprised my helmet went on over it. I'm sweating booze out of every pore, my throat, my nasal passages. I'm sorry, I'm a nose puker. Any nose pukers in place? Boy, you quit forever, didn't you? Oh, yeah, the nose pukers always quit forever. And all my nasal passages are raw. I got a tremor in my hands. My eyelids are made out of sandpaper. I have thrown the oxygen selector lever to 100%. 100% oxygen will not cure a hangover. I've talked to 10 or 12 professional pilots in our fellowship, and nobody ever had a hangover cured by oxygen. It ain't so. Trust me. I tried it hundreds of times. Never worked once. And I am dying in this airplane. And I'm tied up under the leader's tail. You know what I just described for you? You know what that is? That's willpower. That is precisely what that is. It's willpower. We alcoholics have astonishing willpower to have lived through what we live through. I don't think the earth people should be allowed to say willpower. They don't have the faintest notion what it means. But I mean, I give you an example. That's why they don't become alcoholics, is they don't have the willpower for it. Well, the guy goes out on prom night, he drinks a pint of Jack Daniels, he pukes on his date's dress, he wrecks his truck, he wakes up in the drunk tank, and he says, I'm never doing that again. And he never does. Obvious lack of willpower, wouldn't you say? I think it's pretty clear. And I'm dying in this airplane. And by 5:30 that afternoon, my body is responding. I was in my early 20s, and I'm not well yet, but I'm feeling an awful lot better. And the one thing I know for absolute sure and certain is I ain't getting drunk tonight. No way am I getting drunk tonight. But I do want to socialize with the other pilots in my squadron, so I think I'll drop by the officers' club and have one beer, no more than... I should be home by 6:30, no later than... But I leave the club at exactly 1 because they... And I drive home drunk, and I listen to her, and I puke my guts out, and God get me out of this. Yeah, some of you got it. All right. Very good. Over and over again. And I was unable to look into the past all the way to yesterday and say, weren't you dying of a hangover yesterday when we lit the afterburners? And the day before and every day last week and every day last month. I was powerless over alcohol and I was ignorant of the fact that I was powerless over alcohol. Rough combination, ignorant and powerless, huh? Rough combination. I graduated second in my pilot training class. Do you believe that? I did. Second. I had the gift. You know, some guys can just absolutely play golf. I could just fly airplanes. I could just, I never did get into an airplane in my whole life. I strapped one on. I could just take it where I wanted it to go. I just had that gift. And I drew an assignment flying a four-engine jet transport, a C-141, if you're familiar with it. Saw one land here. It was great. I flew all over the world for a year, which means I've been drunk on 5 continents and don't have a guess how many islands. And I didn't see any of it. I mean, you know, all I saw was the bars. There were a few exceptions to that, but not many. I drew an assignment to South Vietnam, flying a gunship, the old DC-3 with the machine guns in the back. Puff the Magic Dragon is what the press called it. Spooky was the call sign. And I was in the Delta flying a gunship. And they were phasing that aircraft out, and I kept moving. And I was eventually put flying an intelligence mission in the old DC-3. And I was at Phu Cat Air Base, South Vietnam, up around the middle of the country. And I was drinking tequila one night in the officer's club. Any guys ever drinking tequila? Huh? You probably shouldn't do that. I'm not supposed to give advice, but you shouldn't do that, okay? And for me, tequila was traveling juice. You know, I'm drinking tequila. I need to be someplace else. And I need to be there right now. Yeah, well, I woke up someplace else. You ever wake up someplace else? Anybody ever wake up someplace else? So I woke up someplace else. And fortunately enough, I was still on the airbase and collected my things, and I'm in my flight suit and boots, sunglasses and hat. I was a captain by this time, and I'm walking across the base, a couple of 3 miles, I guess, from where I awakened to where I would have expected that I would awaken. And 6 o'clock in the morning or something, and in that magic place between drunk and hungover, you know, one of my favorite spots. And I'm walking across the base, and I passed about 20 enlisted guys, one or two at a time at that time of the morning, and they all saluted me, but they had the strangest expressions on their faces. And I thought, how can these enlisted guys know I was a jerk in the officers' club last night? My heavens, this word has traveled fast. I can't figure this out. And I walked into the trailer that I lived in. I walked into the bathroom and looked in the mirror, and I'm missing the lens out of one side of my sunglasses, folks. And the exposed eyeball is this color, okay? Miss Linda and I are just back from Hong Kong. I had this made. What do you think? Oh, man. Okay. It was just a few weeks after that that the colonel came to me, my commanding officer came to me, and he said, Captain Lee, you have such a fine rapport with the enlisted men. They really respect you, and you get along well with them, and I'm concerned about several of them's drinking. Would you counsel them for me? And I said, yes, sir, I'd be glad to. And I counseled a couple of tech sergeants one morning with about a 4-5 hangover myself about their drinking. True story, amazing. I was eventually flying an extremely, a very, very highly classified mission. Let's leave it there. And I was so drunk at 4 o'clock one morning taxiing my aircraft out. Now, I tell you how smart I was. I knew I was drunk. I don't think I could have driven the crew bus from the quarters to the flight line because those roads are kind of narrow, but the taxiways and runways are pretty wide. And I was taxiing the aircraft out. Now, this is not my co-pilot's fault, okay? He was running the checklist and doing the things inside the airplane he's supposed to do. They tried to get me out of the seat, but the problem that they had was that I'm the commanding officer of everybody in sight. There's a little political problem there. And I'm real drunk. And the agreement we finally struck is he said, if I say I've got it, you'll let go. And I said, okay. So Lee, we crank them up. We're taxiing out. And David is setting the flaps and checking the engines and doing the things that a co-pilot is supposed to do. And I'm looking outside driving. Now, I have my side window open just in case I throw up. I can throw up out of the airplane. Pretty smart, don't you think? That's how smart, and I can remember thinking how smart I was to have my window open in case I puked. I could puke out of the plane. I just think that's brilliant. I'm about to fly with a very, very, very drunken pilot. Does that strike you as highly intelligent? Well, anyway, I'm taxiing this beast south, and David's looking inside doing what he's supposed to do, and we get to the end of the taxi, and I'm trying not to jostle myself. I'm being real smooth on the controls. And I got to the end of the taxiway, and I applied the brakes so smoothly that I did not stop the aircraft. Taxied that beast right off into the weeds off the end of this taxiway. If it had been 4 in the afternoon instead of 4 in the morning, if there had been a plane taxiing behind mine, if there had been a stump out there or a ditch or a rock, somebody else talks to you this morning, and I'm probably still in a military prison somewhere because I was drunk. I'm not this wussy .10 DUI social drinker drunk. I'm talking about drunk. Never mind. You know what I'm talking about. This one counted. I had a full load. And I want to tell you that I'm supposed to be serving life in prison. And I have the high honor and privilege of carrying meetings into jails and prisons in my hometown on a very regular basis. Anybody else here doing that? Could I see your hands? Who's taking meetings into the joint? Okay. Just a few. All right. There's nothing like it. I've never been arrested, by the way. If you're not going because you don't have an arrest record, let me tell you a secret. The people on the inside of the jails and prisons already know how to get arrested. They didn't need your help on that. Okay? That doesn't bring anything to their party. What they need is to learn how to... I heard a great misread on how it works. This guy read, "Rarely have we seen a person in jail who has thoroughly followed our path." I think that's right. My home group has taken 50 meetings a month into jails and prisons. We've got 80 members in my group. We've got 25 of us active in the jails. And we're having a ball with it. We're about to do our third weekend in the jail where 8 of us and 50 inmates are going to do an intensive step weekend. We get them 3 hours Friday night, Saturday from 8 in the morning till 5, and Sunday from 8 till noon. And we're going to take 50 inmates to the work. And they had to volunteer to come be with us to do that. If that kind of thing interests you, I'd like to talk to you later. If you're suffering from depression, I'm going to get controversial here. I'd like to recommend that you get with one of these people to hand their hand up and take a couple of meetings into the jail. It will break a depression faster than anything else I've ever seen, and unlike a lot of what's being prescribed for our people, it will not have a negative impact on your recovery. Now, forgive me if that rubs somebody wrong. That's my experience. And I got a phone call a few months ago from a guy in Pennsylvania that I've never met. said he'd heard my talk, and he was depressed, and he took a couple meetings into the jail, and it broke his depression. He said it worked for him. It works for me. I come out of there a foot off the ground with tears running down my face, and somebody asked my bride, Miss Linda, what she thought about all the time I spent in jail, and she said, I love it, because I love who he is when he comes out of there. Because, see, I get the gift. Something. It's not about the door slams and I go home to her, and they're stuck there. It's not about that. It's about going out of my way to maybe be a tool in the master's hand. That's what that's about. I had an experience a couple of years ago eating lunch in a little restaurant in Nashville, and this fellow walks up to my table and he says, you don't remember me, do you? I said, no, if I should, I apologize, but I don't know you. And he says, well, you came into a prison I was in a couple of years ago, and you spoke, and I heard you, and I believed you, and I'm doing the things that you said, and I'm never going to be locked up again in my whole life, and I want to thank you for my freedom, and I've been overpaid for the rest of my life. Guy's out on the street, and he's doing good, because I missed Monday Night Football. I couldn't tell you who was playing that night. If that touches your heart at all, get with somebody. You don't have to commit for the rest of your life. Just go try it once or twice and see what happens. It's been a joy to me. I promise you it has. Anyway, let me go back. We're off the end of the runway in kind of trouble. Somebody may be wondering how we got out of that. My flight engineer hopped off the plane and ran around and came back on, and he says, it looks okay. It's like a putting green out here. It's flat and there's no trouble. He said, lock the left brake and run up number two. And I ground looped this thing back around to the parallel taxiway, and we took the active runway and took off. And you may be wondering how you could fly that drunk, and I'm going to tell you. It's a big sky, you know. Don't take my word for it. Next time you're outside, have a look. It's big. If you look closely, you'll notice there isn't much up there. So the trick if you're flying really drunk is to keep the airplane up in the sky part. That's really all there is to it. Well, everything you hit was on the ground, wasn't it? It's obvious if you think about it. I used to sit in those cockpits and tell other pilots, I can't believe they pay us to do this. I just can't believe they pay us to do this. I loved it so dearly. And after 5 years, I resigned my commission and walked away, and I was not in trouble. I was a time bomb. Alcohol didn't take away my dreams. It took away any chance they had of coming true. That's what it took. And I got a job as a sales rep. I eventually got a business partner in the summer of 1984. He realized I was in trouble. And he told me I was going to treatment right now, or we were tearing the blanket. And I couldn't dial my own home phone number in three tries. I was in bad shape. And on June the 28th of 1984, which is my sobriety date, it's also my belly button birthday. And, yeah, I mentioned that because, and it still is. And I mention that because that's the only thing I didn't have to change. I think that's kind of important. And I didn't think, when I walked into the treatment center and they told me I was going to have to quit drinking booze and stop using the alcohol substitutes that I was using, I didn't think I was ever going to have any more fun. I didn't think I was ever going to laugh out loud, enjoy a joke or a ball game or a weekend or even smile. The textbook says stupid, boring, and glum. And that's what I thought my life was going to be without it. I'm here to report that is not the case. Not the case. Have you heard the laughter this weekend? Have these other speakers been fantastic? I mean, can you believe what's going on here this weekend? Boy. I think they were just spectacular. I'm honored to have my name on that list. I promise you I am. But anyway, I didn't sleep the first three nights I was in treatment. And they say on somebody who's on the mixture I was on, that's not uncommon. And I'm laying there the fourth night knowing I'm not going to sleep one more time. And as some of you may recall, if you're not drinking and you're not sleeping, man, this stays dark a long time. And now, oh, geez, I think it'd ever be over. And, yes, lights out at 11. You got to stay in the room until 6:30. Jesus, it'll never be over. And I'm laying there on my back in this bed, and this review of my life happened to me. I did not do any of what I'm about to describe to you. And it was, if you've had a near-death experience in one of those zip-pop things, I'd love to hear about it. I collect those. I'm fascinated by it. This is not what I had. What I had was over a long period of time, I saw my life in very small segments. And I'd always given myself credit for my intentions. I'm probably the best intended person you've ever run across. And one of my favorite intentions, I used to be an amateur magician. I did close-up. And I intended to get a clown suit. And one of these days when I was on the road, instead of running the saloons, I'm put on the clown suit, go to Children's Hospital, take my kid in and do a magic show for the kids. Pretty fabulous, don't you think? I mean, only a really spectacular guy would do that kind of thing. And one of these days, I'm going to do that. And I'm taking full credit for it, okay? Taking full credit, because I really am one of these days. And only a grand guy would do that, and I'm the guy that would in one of these days. And our third step talks about a decision, and for me, the difference between an intention and a decision is that an intention is followed by more intentions. A decision is followed by action. And that's the difference. And this night, laying in this hospital room, I am not able to see the intentions. They're gone. The story isn't quite so pretty without the intentions. And I got to the place where I began to think about the single worst thing I had ever done. I have one that stands alone. And I'd always been able to stop it before. Three fast scotches would do that. Right? Six-pack will take that right out. Man, I'm laying in a bed in a treatment center. I can't even leave the room. And I have no way to stop it. And I lay there and thought about what I had done. And I was so ashamed and I hated myself so much that I reached what I call bottom. We use the term a lot. I don't see its definition in my literature. So I have only my experience with it. Bottom for me was not on the physical plane. I had puked blood a couple of times. I'd been in plenty of kinds of trouble. I know men that are serving long prison sentences that are not at bottom. Bottom for me was of the spirit. Bottom happened in here when I hated my guts so bad and was so repulsed by the things that I'd done that I would pay any price and do anything not to be the man who did those kinds of things. That for me was bottom. And at that point from in here in my chest, this didn't come out of my throat, didn't happen in my head, did not come out of my mouth, all right? From in here, screamed to a God that I don't think I believed in and screamed, God, forgive me. I'm laying on my back on this bed with my eyes closed, and suddenly I can see the entire room. This, what I'm about to describe to you all happened in an instant. Suddenly, with my eyes still closed, I can see the entire room. There's this magnificent light shining just on me. And a weight was lifted. It's like when you've had x-rays taken of your teeth and you're in the dentist chair, and when they finish, they pick that leaded blanket up off of you. That's what it felt like. Something very heavy was lying just on my body, and it flew up off of me at a very high rate of speed. And my body felt so light, I actually thought I was going to float up off of the bed. It felt like I would float off the bed. I was so light. And I lay there in the presence of infinite love, and I knew in that instant that there was a God, that I was in that God's presence, that God had the power to forgive me, and I was forgiven. And I took the first three steps, I think, in that moment. And I lay there in the Master's presence for a while. I'm not aware of anything else that passed between us. That doesn't mean it didn't happen, because this mind of mine doesn't pick it all up. And I lay there in the presence of infinite love for a while. And I've talked to a few other people who've had similar experiences, and I'll report that we all will tell you that in that presence, what we call time does not exist. And I couldn't tell you if it was 0.2 seconds or 3 or 4 hours how long I lay there in that presence. I do not know. But I know that I must have slept a little after that, because I awakened the next morning, and I hadn't awakened in 3 mornings in a row. I've been awake all night. And I awakened the next morning, and I wanted to be one of his guys. And that was my first cornerstone. And I'd like to read from Bill's story, page 12, because he had something similar. It says, "But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. I'd like to report to you that I do not believe that that experience alone would have kept me sober to this day. I do not believe that. If you haven't had one of these and feel like you've been shortchanged, I don't think so. And I love remembering it. It was a beautiful gift for me. And I think I was hanging real close to the edge. I think I was close to death and was not aware of it. And I think maybe that's how I got that. I can't answer any questions. I just don't know. But I know that that alone would not have done it. And I set out to try to do what I was told. I knew I had to make some changes. And that was my first cornerstone. A couple of weeks later, I went into my counselor's office, 11 o'clock one morning. He's working on my aftercare plan. I knew it. And I went in there to assist him with it. And if you're new and you don't know why that's funny, please listen very closely. This is important for you, okay? And I walked through the door and I explained to him that I wasn't going to halfway house, that I was not going to take ant abuse, and they had a 28-day program and I wasn't staying a minute longer. And he said, well, and I just did that to lay out the parameters to help the man do his job. I'm just trying to be helpful, okay? Great attitude. And he said, well, you've left out something you aren't going to do. I said, what? He said, you aren't going to make it, man. I took that personally. And I'm not a violent man by nature, but I make exceptions. And I made a verbal one with him. And I was fluent, by the way, in those days in the language of the gutter. And I proved it to him. And generally what I said was, "Why'd you say that to me?" That's not an exact quote. And his response changed. And I'd like to honor you again. He was a member of Al-Anon. And it changed my life. And I owe you a huge debt. I honor you again. And he asked me the question that changed my life. He said, "If you already know how to run a program to keep yourself sober, how is it you happen to be a patient here?" And I responded by saying, and nothing came out, and I've never had that experience before. Have you? Did you always have an answer? I always had an answer. I had to make some of them up, but I always had an answer. Couldn't answer the man's question. I'd never seen an unanswerable question before. I was thrilled. My mind glommed onto it like an English bulldog on a rat. Started shaking it. I assumed that I was in his office for an hour. What I've just described to you happened in the first 5 minutes. I have no memory of the rest of that hour. What he said, what I said, whatever happened, my mind is hanging on to the unanswerable question. I left there and went to lunch, and through lunch I thought about it. And after lunch, my body went that afternoon to the places it was assigned. Oh, you know, group and coping skills and phys ed, whatever they had. My body was there. My mind was back in this man's office trying to answer the unanswerable question. My wife and I had the privilege of speaking back at that treatment center in June this last year. And I got to go to the place where this happened to me. And I'm walking back to my cottage that night, about 9 o'clock, it's dusk. And I'm walking, and I got the answer, and it came the same place as the prayer. I'm walking, and all of a sudden it goes... And the answer was and is, I don't know how to run a program to keep myself sober. And if I am going to be one of the very few who make it, I'm going to have to do it all. I'm going to have to do it all. My wager is too high. I have too many chips in this pot. This is not a smorgasbord kind of buffet lunch like they had down here where take what you want and leave the rest for me. Because my wager is too high. Here's my recovery. Let me show you what's hanging from it. My freedom. Told you I'm supposed to be serving life in prison. My very life. How many times could a drunken pilot have been killed? Plus, I drove cars and, you know, all the silly things you did. I couldn't impress you with a number. You got a big number, too. My sanity. I have been to the insane asylum. I was an inmate. I was hallucinating. I've been into the little rubber room. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands on that, but I've been there. My relationship with this fabulous woman could not be what it is today. My relationship with our children, my house, my car, my job, everything, my peace of mind, everything in my life that means anything to me is suspended from my recovery. Because if I lose it, everything in my life that means anything to me hits the floor and shatters. I don't know where you are. I stand there today. That's when I am right now. And what I have done is I have wagered all of that, that what's in this book will work for me. That's my wager. That's what I'm here to talk about. And at that point, walking in that treatment center, when I got that reality that I don't know how to run this thing, I surrendered to what I lovingly call Step 1, Section B. Oh, my life's unmanageable. Oh, okay. I was confused because on the day before I went to treatment, the fact that I was powerless over alcohol and the fact that my life was a disaster were related. And I was confused about that unmanageable thing. I've read this book more than once. I read 2 pages a day. I read 2 pages this morning. I require that of the men that I sponsor. We read the book from Roman numeral 11 to 164, 2 pages a day. Read the book 4 times a year like that. That's one day at a time applied to reading the big book. And so I try to stay current in the work. But I've read it a number of times, and I can't find the place, if somebody could quote me a page, I would be much appreciative, that says, "Congratulations, now having achieved this high spiritual level, your life is now manageable. Tank is full. The keys are in it. Go get them." Somebody, what page? Okay, I can't find a place that says my life's going to be manageable by me, but my life is no longer insane. I can show you at least 2 pages that promise sanity, actually 3. So sanity returns, and part of my sanity is that based on my performance, I have fired me as general manager of my own life. You would have fired me decades ago. And I've invited God in, not as the 12 and 12 says, as a Bush League pitch hitter. I've invited God in as God, to run my life. I invited him in this morning. I don't surrender anymore. I volunteer. I volunteered this morning and asked God to please run my life. And he has a first sergeant. We call him Ice Cream Steve at my home group. It's my sponsor. And I'm surrendered to my sponsor. And if the ice cream man says it, I just simply do it. And I don't argue with him. I only ask him questions when I'm not sure I understood what he said. Because my disease continues to flourish up here in my head. And when I surrender totally to my sponsor, what I've done is I've taken my disease out of the decision-making process as it applies to my recovery. Does that make sense to you? It's been working for me for 18 and a half years. Anyway, I zipped through that 28-day treatment program in 6 weeks flat. And, I've always been a quick study, huh? Went back to Nashville, where the only person in the entire city that I knew that was in recovery owned one of the businesses I called on, and I didn't want him to know. Newcomer thinking, right, Bill? There's nothing quite like it, is there? Oh, nothing like it. I set out to follow the aftercare plan, which said 90 meetings in 90 days. I tried very hard to do that. I only went to 87. I can remember there was one night I was just about to leave for the meeting, and my son decided to try to learn to dance standing up in a rocking chair. And we went to the emergency room instead of the meeting. So I missed 3 meetings for reasons like that. So I only went to 87 because, see, I didn't know you could go to 2 meetings in a day. Because I was a newcomer and I had newcomer thinking. And they said stay away from your old playmates and playgrounds. My favorite watering hole's on 8th Avenue South in Nashville. And I had a 2-year chip in my pocket the first day I allowed my vehicle to turn onto 8th Avenue South. Not just near there. I was not on that street. I was that serious about it. I completed this psychobabble piece of garbage 4-step guide the treatment center had given me. I'd like to recommend the actual 4-step that's in this book. It will change your life. I promise you it will. I find it to be a series of lists and observations and prayers that it is my experience that it is the observations and prayers that make the changing. And none of the prayers and most of the observations are not written. So if all you've done is written a 4-step, I propose that you may have missed some of the most powerful stuff we got. If that's your case, please see me or somebody else who just lit up and applauded, and let's talk about what's really in this book on this thing. I'm privileged occasionally to do a workshop on step 4. It takes me 2 hours to cover the 4-step. That's what it took on Friday. It was 2 hours on steps 3 and 4. Powerful, powerful stuff. Not that I'm a grand wizard, but what's in this book works. But anyway, I completed this, you know, do you still hate your mother? Multiple choice, fill in the blanks. Do you look in the toilet before you flush? Question thingy, psychobabble. And it didn't do me any, the only thing it did for me is it got me to step 5. If you're new and you've looked at the steps and they look to you like they're designed to punish you, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how they look to us. That was one of the many, many things I was wrong about. What the steps do is they bring me relief. They bring me relief. And if I'd done a real 4-step, I'd have gotten relief there. I did the psychobabble thing and all it did was get me to 5. I called down to the treatment center to Bernie, who had not been my counselor, but he was a counselor down there, and I'd asked him if he'd hear my 5th step. Because when I had my big spiritual experience, I knew I was going to have to tell somebody the whole truth about my story. And the reason I selected Bernie is because you could look at him and tell he was stoned out of his mind. Well, really, I mean, you know what it looks like when somebody's ripped? He's got this real relaxed face, this dumb little grin, and whenever he moves real slow, and he giggles a lot. I thought, hey, I'm going to take my 5th step with this junkie. A week later, will he know what I said? He won't know if we did it. What a good choice he was, right? That makes sense to you. So I called the treatment center. He said, sure. We booked an appointment. I drove from Nashville to Atlanta. It's about 4 hours. I took my 5th step with Bernie, and I began to get relief, because that's what the steps do. I began to get relief. If I'd done a real 4-step, I'd have had a bunch of relief before I got to him. And I headed back for Nashville. And just sort of as an aside, Bernie, by the way, was not stoned. Bernie was sober over 20 years. That was serenity. I didn't know what it looked like. I mean, just newcomer thinking. There isn't anything quite like it on the planet. And at 4.5 months sober, I've done everything on the aftercare plan except get a sponsor. And y'all were able to do it at the workshop. I'm sure you can again today. But I'm going to let you fill in this blank. It's 2 words, all right? I was so insane that I was looking for a sponsor I could relate to. Isn't that hilarious? Holy mackerel. I can't figure out that you can go to 2 meetings in a day. Who can I relate to? I can relate to the squirrel on the next branch who does not know his fanny from a hot rock either. That's who I can relate to. Boy, did I ever not need a sponsor I could relate to. Holy mackerel, did I ever not need that. What I needed was a sponsor I would obey. It was a rather foreign concept to me. Anyway, there's this one particular guy, and his lights were on. I told the story the other day. I don't have time for the whole thing. But I went to him. I said, Jerry, would you sponsor me? And he said, yeah, here's your first assignment. I said, what assignment? Well, I thought it was like I was getting like a big brother who was going to kind of show me the ropes and fix my wife. And that wasn't it. She wasn't on his caseload. But he gave me an assignment, and I did it. And by the tapes, or ask me later, I'll be glad to tell you what it was. I came back to him a week later and said, okay, I did what you said. And he said, I'll sponsor you my way. I said, what does that mean exactly? And he said, you are too sick to stay sober on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And I didn't know what he was talking about. Jerry outlived what the doctor said by over 10 years. That's not uncommon among us, by the way, because his mission wasn't over. We knew why. And he said to the end, he thought the very best kept secret in our fellowship was the definition of our program. And how do we keep it secret? Well, we read it at almost every meeting. That's how we keep it secret. It's on page 59 in the text, in what we affectionately call How It Works. It's the sentence before the first step where it says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a
program of recovery.
No steps, no program, period. All right? That's the deal. Forgive me for being harsh, but I've been to too many funerals of people who thought don't drink and go to meetings was our program. We're killing people with that. I'm going to ask you a question. If don't drink and go to meetings is the program, if sitting around with a bunch of other alcoholics talking about our problem is going to get people sober, wouldn't the guys under the Woodland Street Bridge in Nashville, Tennessee be sober right this second? That's not it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. It has been my experience in 18 and a half years that I have not yet seen one single individual in and out of the program. I ain't seen it yet. In another fellowship, oh yeah, I see that every day. I have not seen one single individual do take work, the 12 steps. I don't care what the action verb is. Action verb, the 12 steps. While being coached by a sponsor who's already done them. And stay active carrying our message and drink again. I have not seen it. I'll be astounded if any of you have. Anybody seen that? I didn't think so. I have the privilege of asking that question to 10 to 20,000 of us a year. And no hands go up. This is not some get it and some don't. This is some do it and some don't. It's the way it looks to me. If I'm being harsh, I do apologize, but I have been to too many funerals of nice people like us who tried to slide by on a bunch of other stuff. And so anyway, Jerry told me that's the definition of the program, and you're going to work the steps at the pace I'm going to set. And I was rigorously honest with Jerry. I want to recommend that you be rigorously honest with your sponsor. I said, Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. I'd looked at 9. I couldn't believe you were even serious about that. And I said, Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. And he said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, as long as you do them. Jerry, buddy, we're graduates of the same university. That's one of the reasons I chose you. We're not communicating. He said, oh, we are communicating. That's the definition of willingness. Willingness is when you do what your sponsor says, whether you want to or not. Oh. He said, did you try to get sober on your own? Yeah, a couple thousand times. Doing what you thought you needed to do and not doing what you didn't think you needed to do? That's right. How'd it work? I just hated it when he got that way. But I still don't want to do it, so I said, why? Jerry did not answer why questions for the men that he sponsored, and I don't either, except for this single one. Why do I have to do the 12 steps? That one he answered. He said, the reason that we don't answer why questions is because step one, section B, says very clearly, you are not in management. Management is a why question. Consequently, all of the why questions have the same answer, and the answer is, you don't need to know. I did not like that when I first heard it. Today, it's one of my cornerstones. I love it. Because I always thought it was not knowing that made me crazy. Uh-uh. It was needing to know that made me crazy. Oh, yeah, the problem was in here. My sponsor used to have, his answering machine used to say that. You'd call, and he wasn't there. He'd go ring, ring, click, click. It ain't them. It ain't them. It ain't them. Leave a message. Beep. 2 or 3 years, that was his answering machine. I'm not kidding you. So I said to Jerry, I said, why do I have to do these 12 steps? And he said, think of yourself as a garbage can. Okay, that's easy. I got that piece. All right, what we're going to do with these steps is we're going to dump you out. We're going to scrub the can clean and stand it back upright. We're going to fish through your life, and most of it's garbage, and we are going to throw it away. But some of it is good. That portion we will keep. He gave two examples. Excuse me. He said, do you love your children? I said, I love my children very much. He said, great. We'll keep that part. And then he got smart. He said, when you go to work, you do a good job, don't you? I said, yes, I do. He said, well, we'll keep some of that. When we get finished with this work, you're going to be a big clean can with just a little bit of good stuff in the bottom. See, because you're full of poison. And if we just fill with the good stuff, it's still in there. It's going to explode. So we got to dig it out. And that's what some of this step work's about. Our program's kind of like going to the dentist. We've got to fill. We got to drill before we can fill. We've got to get the poison out of there. But the good news is we got Novocaine. We got sponsorship. We got fellowship. We got home group. We got love. Come get some. Okay? It's not as bad as you think it's going to be. That's just one of the other things that you're wrong about. Boy, and I'm still saying why. Because I'm looking for the door. And he said, the reason you have to do that is because alcohol's not your problem. I said, it's not? He said, no. Eventually it's your problem, but all your life it's been your answer. It's been your answer. It's what made you tall enough and smart enough and good-looking enough and a good enough dancer and made you as good as everybody else. It's really the only answer you've ever known. When we say to you, lay down booze, we're not saying, put down your problem. We're saying, lay down the only answer you have ever known. The only thing that ever made your skin fit. The only thing that ever made your life work. The only thing that ever made you as good as everybody else. Let's lay that down. And when I do that, it leaves me without an answer. And what I need is a new answer. Because that was such a big answer. And I needed the new answer. And the new answer is I needed to be changed into the kind of guy who not only doesn't drink, but isn't thirsty for a drink. That was the hard part. I could go for weeks and months sometimes without a drink. But I'm vibrating, all right? So I needed to be changed. And I looked, I love the way Betsy read the 12th step. I think the first line of the 12 steps, the most powerful promise I've ever seen anywhere, says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result. That's what she read. It doesn't say a result. I hear it read that way. It's not what it says. The is singular. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, it is my experience that spiritually awakened people not only don't drink beverage alcohol, they don't want to. They're not thirsty for it. And they lead exciting, fun, productive lives. Now, there are low spots. I promise you, like the man last night did, I promise you low spots. But boy, by and large, it is quite a package. Quite a package. So I needed to be transformed into that kind of guy. And what I needed to do was to work those 12 steps so that I could have that spiritual awakening. Because the big boom experience that I had, the burning bush thing, was insufficient. It's not enough. I'm still full of the poison. I had to do the step work. And he said, the reason that you have to do that, he said, one of these days, something bad, something strong, something horrible is going to just slam into your heart. Just bang, 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 bang. You're going to get that one of these days. The example he gave, he said, your father's going to die. And on that day, if you don't have that big, clean can with just a little bit of good stuff in the bottom, that empty, clean space to store that pain in while we love you back to spiritual health, you will escape. You're an escape artist. You escape the now. And the only escapes you know are killing you and they're devastating everybody around you. And I just ran out of why. And I allowed the man to coach me through the 12 steps. And I've had a spiritual awakening as the result. And I did have the big slam into the heart. I'm going to tell you a horror story. Hear me this first. It has a very, very happy ending, okay? Carry that, because I'm fixing to hurt you. My beautiful daughter, on July the 4th of 1993, put a pistol in her mouth and fired it. Her brother and I found her about 5 hours later, as best we can tell. Horror. We were at Vanderbilt Hospital within 30 minutes. Within 30 minutes after that, there were 20 or 30 of you in the lobby having a prayer meeting. By dark, it looked just like this. Looked just like this. And they told us for the first 4 days that they could not save her. 4 days is a long time to sit at your baby's side, holding her hand. And she can't talk, but she's conscious now. She's a nightmare to look at. She's got these tubes stuck in her. But she can squeeze your hand once for yes and twice for no. And she don't want to die anymore. And 4 days is a long time. It's a very long time. And I believe if I had not allowed the man to coach me through those 12 steps that I couldn't have done it. I think I would have committed murder. And heaven knows what else would happen. And it just wasn't necessary. Didn't happen that way. And you people were spectacular. Allow me to tell you what you did. You put a 24-hour watch on me. I didn't leave the hospital for 60 days. And you put a 24-hour watch on me. And there was not a time in the next 60 days that there wasn't a member of my home group at least as close to me as I am to Tammy here in the front row. There was no time in the next 60 days that you weren't physically there. I know who you are. I saw what you did. And Al-Anon, we learn not to trust the words, but to trust the actions. Let me tell you something. You can pretend to care. You can't pretend to show up. You guys showed up, and you were there. And it wasn't, if you're new, it wasn't to keep me from drinking. You ain't keeping me from drinking. They didn't even think about that. It was so that one of my people would be there to hold me if I needed to cry at 3 in the morning or 3 in the afternoon. That's why you were there. I had learned to cry when I was sober a year. There was a guy in my home group cried in every meeting, and I couldn't figure it out. Very masculine guy. And I went to him. I said, Tony, talk to me about the tears. And he said, well, somebody says something beautiful, and it touches my heart, and I weep, and it feels so good. And I said, Tony, I can't cry. And he said, I'll teach you. And he did. And I can cry today. And I'm very proud of that. And if you, by the way, if that gives you now disrespect for me, I'm okay with it. I mean, God bless you. God bless you. There was a guy named Cherry Carpenter in Nashville, sober 1,000 years when I got sober. And he used to say, I'd rather be despised for who I really am than loved for who I'm not. And I could not say that when I got here. I can now. I hope you like me. I really hope you like me. And I am okay if you don't. And I did not have that when I got here. Yeah, did not have that. And by the way, if you'd like to learn to cry, see me after the meeting. I got a handout. I can teach you. And it's one of my passions. It's one of my passions. Anyway, my daughter lived, and she's doing great. She's doing just great. She sends you love. She's married to a wonderful young man that we just think the world of. And she's doing great. She sends you love. And I sponsor a man whose son did not live. And I have his permission to tell you what he said. Now, emotionally, he was gone a long time. Hear me clearly. He did not drink again, and he took no drugs. But emotionally, he was gone. You could get up close to his face and talk real loud, and he just couldn't hear you. He just wasn't there for about a year. He's back now, and he's doing great. He's doing fantastic. And he said it better than I could, and I quote him where he said, one of these days, you're going to have to go to the mountain all by yourself. And if you've not done the work out of this book, and you don't know how to reach up and take the master's hand, you're not going to be able to go. I believe that. That just drains me sometimes to tell that. Anyway, my baby's doing great. She's doing just great. She sends you love. Try to lighten up a little bit, because that really wears me out. I started going to a clubhouse in Nashville called the Old Woodbine Club, and they had slogans on the wall, and one of them said, first things first. And I understood that, but I was a newcomer. Of course, I wasn't doing it. And right? Sure. And then another one said, let go and let God. I wonder what that means. And another one said, one day at a time. I know what that means. That means don't drink today. And boy, if you're new, it certainly means that. But I'll tell you what my experience is. Eventually, that will be insufficient. Steps 1 through 10 were designed to clean up my past. I've cleaned it. There's nothing gaining on me. I don't have to look over my shoulder. 11 and 12 continue to help me develop a relationship with a loving God who holds my future in his hands, and that suits me. I have a friend who says he spends too much time in his head trying to clear away the wreckage of his future. Been guilty of that, huh? Yeah, okay. So, a loving God holds the future. The past is clean. Those two facts free me to live one day at a time in this day. If I don't have both of those in place, I can't be here. That's a little bit about what the step work's about. Another one on the wall, the one that just made me insane to look at, was the only one I was doing, was think. Oh, baby, did I have that covered. All right. Now, I don't find that in my literature. I don't find that definition anywhere in my literature. So I've taken it upon myself. This is what it means to me. That means three thinks is the limit. Okay? Whatever it is, I can think about it once. That's good. I can think about it twice. If I think about it the third time, I must lay it down. For if I were going to outthink it, I would have outthunk it in three thinks. If I go to the fourth think, I got a problem with step one, section B, I'm trying to manage it. That's right. As a matter of fact, everything in my life that upsets me because I think I'm supposed to be managing it. Right? It's all a function of being right about something. I've never been angry when I wasn't also right. Huh? Play with that a little bit and see what you get. That's been my experience about it. But anything that upsets me, it's I got a problem with step one, section B. I'm upset about it because I think I ought to be managed. And that's everything from international politics to the way you drive your car to the way this fabulous woman I'm married to puts the toilet paper on the roll backwards. It should feed over the top, as you well know. Over the top, as you well know, okay? Should feed over the top, yeah. Let me tell you what she says. You want to hear a cheap excuse? She says she puts it on the other way because we have a cat. Let me tell you something. Been watching that cat for 10 years. He don't use it. Isn't that fun? For those of you who have made the mistake and missed her talk, I'd like to introduce you to my lovely wife, Linda. Would you please stand? I know how much you hate this. When I was sober 6 years, I moved out of the house my first wife and I were living in. I was standing in front of her and she was tearing into me again. And I'm 6 feet and 200 pounds and she's 5'5 and 105. And I had this moment of clarity. And the moment of clarity said, if you don't get out of here right now, you're going to give her a straight right. And when she goes down, you're going to follow up. And she's going to the hospital, you're going to the jail, and it's a bad plan. It's a bad plan. And I literally did an about face and walked out of there and started looking for an apartment. And 2 days later, 48 hours, I'm gone. I moved. And I did not know what to do. I'm not a very religious guy. I'm not to this day. I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. But I didn't believe in divorce. And I also knew to the depths of my soul that if I lived with her, I was going to beat her up. And I knew that was wrong. And I didn't know what to do. And I was given a gift. And I share it with you just in case you need the gift. I was given the gift of three prayers, and I prayed them every morning. And the prayers were, God, if it's your will for us to be together, put us together. And God, if it's your will for us to be apart, put us apart. Those are the easy ones. Here's the hard one. Here's the one that counts. And God, if it's your will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing. That's the one for me. When I got a big deal, that's the one I have to do. If it's your will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing. The today word is magic. One day at a time, today. I got to live in this day. And his guidance will be here right on time. Be here right on time. And if I only get a certain amount of spiritual energy on any given day, and if I'm squandering it, worrying about stuff in the future that I have no power over, I'm not going to have enough left for today's assignment. Well, today must be important. Look how many of God's kids he gave it to. So I need to step out of management, and that's how I do it. And I just share that under for whatever it's worth. I'm going to talk a little bit about my own experience with a couple of the steps. By the way, if somebody disagrees with anything I have to say, I can't wait to hear from you. Let's not talk to you. Let's hear from you. I may learn something. I've had that experience several times speaking, and somebody's come to me and said, I disagree, and I've learned from them. So if you disagree, please help me. Anyway, I walked out of a meeting one time, and a guy whose sponsor I sponsor said, I disagree. And what I'd said in the meeting was that my amends to my children would never be complete. And he said, that's not right. He said, did you go to your children and tell them what you thought you'd done wrong? Did you ask for their forgiveness? Did you ask what you could do to make it right and do that to the best of your ability? I said, yeah, I did all that. He said, you're trying to be the best dad you can be. Today is not ninth-step work. It's 12th. That's the principles in all your affairs. People living spiritual lives try to be the best parents they can be. And if you think it's ninth-step work, you have not accepted their forgiveness or God's or your own. If you're making living amends, it's okay with me. It's not in my book. All right? I can come down off the cross. I'm trying to be the best dad I can be today. It's not because I was a lousy guy in the past. It's because people walking a spiritual life do those kinds of things. So I don't have to feel the guilt anymore. My ninth step's complete. I'm finished with it. I got free. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the worst thing I ever did. I need to preface by telling you that if you've done what I'm about to describe, I'm okay with it, if you're okay with it. I'm not here to indict you. This is not a political discussion. As a young man, I paid for an abortion, and that festered my soul. I drank over it. I had to get the thoughts out of my head, the what-ifs. That's what I was thinking about that night in that treatment center when my soul screamed for forgiveness and received it. But when I got to the ninth step, it looked to me like I owed amends to an unborn child. And I didn't think it could be done. And I have been blessed from my earliest recovery to be in the hands of people who were in the big book. I'd like to read to you from page 83. It says, some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. I was sat down outdoors under God's sky, not indoors under man's roof. And my spiritual advisor prayerfully held the space while I wrote a letter. And like the fourth step is not about writing, there's writing involved, but it was the observations and prayers that were life-changing. This letter, in my experience, is not about writing. It's about tears. If you can't cry, it's my opinion that this will not work for you. I've seen it over and over again. So if you need to learn to cry, recommend you do that first. If you need to do this work, I'd be glad to talk to you. It's just my experience with doing it, and I got free. And I'd be glad to talk to you. I got a handout that will give you how I go about that. The book isn't real broad on that, but I was given some beautiful things that worked for me, so that's all I'm trying to share with you. I want to talk just a little bit about pages 95 and 6 in the book, where it talks about dropping somebody you're trying to sponsor that won't let you. It's really important that I don't work with guys that don't work with me. Because if he's not doing the things I'm asking, because what I'm going to ask him to do is these steps, and I'm going to do it at a pace based on what I know about his life. But I'm going to keep him moving through this work. Because if he won't let me do that, he's only in the fellowship. He's not in the program. And I can't help him. I can't help him anyway. But I can sure carry this message to him. It's my experience that people who allow a sponsor to coach him through this work, they get the spiritual awakening. If he's on the way to that, I can work with him. If he's not, it's incumbent upon me to tell him the truth. I can't let him think he has a sponsor when he doesn't. And if he's not doing what I'm asking, he doesn't have a sponsor. He's his own sponsor. And that wasn't working for him when he asked me. And so I must drop him, and I do that prayerfully and sadly. I don't happen to believe in tough love. And I have to absolutely do it gently, and I say, I'm sorry. I'd love for you to work this program, and you're not doing it. And I can't in good conscience continue. Please understand, you're in the fellowship. You're not in the program. You are not. And I'm doing that so that if your way doesn't work, when you wake up in your next jail and stuck in your own vomit, I want you to have three options. The options are to continue to live that way, take your own life, or try AA knowing you didn't try it. And it's my responsibility to tell him he didn't try it, because if I don't, I've signed his death threat, his death warrant. I think that's important. We don't give our phone numbers to newcomers anymore at my home group. We exchange with them, and we call them, too. We don't wear them out. We call them a couple times. But that seems to work for us. I belong, by the way. I told you the big thing booze did is it made me feel like I was as good as everybody, feel like I belonged. I am as good as everybody in this room, and I do belong. I'm a member here. And I'll be a member here when I wake up tomorrow morning, too. It won't be gone like the booze was. This is for real. I do belong. And it's just, you guys are just spectacular. I'm going to try to tell two more stories. My last flight in a high-performance aircraft, I broke all the rules. You're not supposed to be above 45,000 feet. Ask me later. I'll tell you why. It's very dangerous. And I took this thing to 52,300. It's all it would do. I'm flying at 9/10 of the speed of sound. I can do this with the stick on that plane that roll like that. Nothing happened. There's no air up there. 9:30 on a clear morning, 80 miles west of Jacksonville, out over the Okefenokee Swamp. I just come to a northerly heading when I looked out of the plane for the first time. At 52,300 feet, the sun's coming up over my right shoulder. The sky above me is black on a clear morning at 9:30. And I look out to the west, and I saw the curvature of the earth. I really saw it. This thing's a ball. I saw it. Sense of peace washed over me. In the poem High Flight, the author says, reached out my hand and touched the face of God. I know what he's talking about. And I want to do that again while I'm trapped in this prison. I dream big, folks. I serve a big God. I don't have the power to make a mistake God can't turn into something magnificent. He uses the worst things in my past to help other people. Powerful God. And God forgives me for everything I did, and he loved me while I was doing it. Powerful, gentle God. Dream big. We serve a big God. I'd like to honor that God and thank him. I ask for an open heart, and boy, has this been fast for me this morning. I have had a ball. You people have just been so special, and I thanks for your open hearts. Thanks for inviting your God. If you borrowed mine and it worked, borrow him again. Borrow him again. I was in a little meeting in Knoxville a few years ago, a little discussion meeting, and they come around the room. This old boy is sitting there with his arms folded and this scowl on his face. I couldn't wait an attitude case, you know. And he says, I've just come back from an ancient ritual, from a medieval ceremony where 10,000 people sat in an unair-conditioned auditorium wearing long robes. I figured it out. That's graduation, University of Tennessee. Okay, I got it. Said Alex Haley was the featured speaker, and Mr. Haley was not talking about AA, but what he said reminded this guy of AA so much that he forgot about the air conditioning and the robes, and it does me too. What Alex Haley said that for me defines us so beautifully is, he said, if you ever see a turtle sitting up on top of a fence post, you'll know he's had help. God bless you, and thanks for the help.